But with that, I think it's fair to open the floor back to y'all to say whatever you want. And then if not, if you're done and we don't run out of time, I still would love to kind of sketch the history of the world, so to speak, from the religious perspective, from the left side of the board to the right side of the board, because I think there's some key considerations that we could both speak to in that direction.
Are you had your 20 minutes, Scott?
But the I go back to to quote Sheldon from Big Bang Theory, "Cathedra meum, reguli mei." My house, my rules. Ashley.
I can actually just open it up to any questions or whatever. So
I have random questions. I'll start. Just get the raise ready.
Too slow.
Okay, so when we spoke last, you said that
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, there every generation there can be a messiah. So when I hear that, I think just because of the greatness of God, I can't agree with that.
Okay.
Because then that means that there's somebody, the messiah, A, hasn't overcome the human condition, or B, hasn't, beaten death, which are two things that are really crucial. So how can the Jewish people hold to that there's a possible messiahs walking around that fail?
And one that failed?
Or if here's a messiah in each generation, how can they fail to be actualized?
Can they fail to be actualized?
Like, I see that a fail on God, and how do you guys view that?
So the short answer would be this. I don't know how I'm going to put this, but so we believe in a cooperation between God and mankind. So God can do what his part, we have to do our part. If we don't do our part, his part doesn't get actualized.
So I could say we agree with that.
Yeah, because that is the position of Christianity, minus some theological viewpoints that I still think are minority viewpoints.
But what about the name Emmanuel?
Say it again.
What about the name Emmanuel? And I think we determined last time that for you, Messiah doesn't mean
divine.
So let me finish with the first point though.
Okay.
So you probably heard about the person who's stranded in the ocean and he prays to God for help, right? You guys have all heard that one, and God sends a helicopter, a boat, this, that, and so it was up to him to actually get on the boat. So I would say, on our behalf, it was the Jewish people or the world, etc., to accept Jesus as the Messiah. Let's pretend that I'm going to agree with him. He's the number one candidate. It's our responsibility to go. We accept him, and that's going to be the partnership that will happen. And then that person, whether it's Jesus, Shabbatai Tzvi, Rebbe Schneerson, or whoever, that person will then be actualized. And so then, of course, they will then go on to their messianic reign and so on. I'll give you a good example. King Hezekiah, in rabbinic literature, it says that King Hezekiah, God chose him as the Messiah. And King Hezekiah, according to biblical literature, forget rabbinic literature, is sandwiched between two people, his father and his son. His father, King Ahaz, is, I'm not one to judge a king of Israel.
He's as bad as they get.
Yeah.
But he's not the best. He's not the best king ever. His son that came after him, Manasseh, oh my God, the streets were running red with blood. King Ahaz King Hezekiah did away with all of the things that his dad did. So let's just pretend wanton idolatry, this, that, you name it, everything. He reversed all of that completely, all throughout the land of Israel. He had good commerce with his neighbors, and so on and so on. Rabbinic literature says God had just singled him out. He's the Messiah. Let's find it. Is he of the line of David?
Yes.
He's of the line of David. Not only is he of the line of David, he's actually a sitting king. He's an actual king. Mm-hmm. Not only that,
he's literally anointed. The oil is poured on his head.
And right. Yeah, he's literally anointed to do all this. And given King David is a type, so what we expect is what you see King David doing, you're going to see the Messiah do on a double level, so to speak, or whatever have you. And Hezekiah is fulfilling all of this. He's fighting the wars of God, doing this, uniting all the people, Torah principles, you name it. Anyways, just like Moses, Moses didn't enter the promised land, correct?
Right.
He made a mistake. Right. Now, to us, we might go, really?
That was the mistake.
So Hezekiah makes a mistake, and he doesn't praise God after this victory happened. Basically, the Assyrians were coming to get him. The prophet Isaiah was telling him, because they're related, him and the prophet, because the prophet Isaiah is from the tribe of Judah. He's also raised there in the palace and everything. So him and, in fact, Hezekiah marries Isaiah's daughter, as an aside. So here it is, Hezekiah is being told by Isaiah, don't make treaties with the other nations. God is the one who's going to come and help you. Hezekiah goes, all right. To the dismay of the other people, no, you got to make a treaty with Egypt so we can go ahead and fight the Assyrians and so on. Anyways, long story short, the Assyrians send over 180,000 troops to come and lay siege to Jerusalem. God, or the angel of the Lord, whoever, comes at midnight, and this is during Passover, by the way, according to the Bible, forget rabbinic tradition, according to the Bible, this is during Passover, and I think on the second month, Passover Sheni, wipes out the Assyrian army. Hezekiah doesn't praise God for this miraculous thing. As a result, God's hand is removed from him being actualized as the King Messiah. But notice one thing that's really fascinating here. Was he betrayed for 30 pieces of silver? No. Was he born in Bethlehem? I don't think so. And I can name all these messianic prophecies, so to speak, that doesn't line up with what you would expect Jesus or whoever the future Messiah is or whatever have you. And here it is, God is saying, well, he's the one. Well, what happened to being crucified, suffering, and on and on and on? And here it is, rabbinic literature has this as him. The other part is we also have these people who were before Jesus who claim to be messiahs, after Jesus who claim to be messiahs, and we will grant that all of these people, so to speak, are possible messiahs. We failed on our behalf. You can see, even like in recent times, with this person, Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the literature that is put out is, hey, the people of Israel have to do their part in order for the Messiah to be actualized. I'll give a real easy one. The temple doesn't exist today, right?
Right.
So sitting right there is the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Well, here's the truth of the matter. And this is in all honesty, he's recording, just like this. If
we can cut it out of here.
if we were to seriously just trust in God and go there and build the temple, this is the opinion of the rabbis and so on, us united as the Jewish people to go and do this, then the temple would be rebuilt. And we're going to start offering sacrifices again and so on. And God will back our plan. He'll totally back it. But we're not there. I'll give you another one. During the building of the second temple.
What would happen if they, in order to say, raise Al-Aqsa, which means everybody, but not like Israel hadn't.
Yeah,
been there. I watched a Jewish family get approval to go in, and they were followed around with rifles. I was like, oh.
So I would also say, I would back up his, I would agree with him. The only way that this objection that you're raising works is in two possibilities. One, because it's a principle that we agree with and have to on Christianity, is the offer of salvation is to all, but it's not actualized by all. It's powerful enough for all, but it isn't actualized in every case. The principle is identical here with Messiah. The question is, did God promise Messiah will come, period? So regardless of what you do, Messiah is going to come. Or did he promise it contingently? If he promised that Messiah will come, then there can be a Messiah every generation, and it doesn't get actualized. That would still at least logically make sense until the last one when he does get actualized. If it's truly contingent and there was never a promise that Messiah will come regardless, then all these can fail to be actualized and God is still true, but man was the fallen part of that. So I would agree with him that I don't think that objection can be sustained in the face of the claim of there's a Messiah born every generation. The question is, what's the justification for believing a Messiah is born every generation versus there was a sovereign plan that already knows what it will be in the future? because so you guys know the position from which I usually operate the class is a position of mental knowledge. That is to say, God knows the counterfactuals of what you're going to do, what he's going to do, what I'm going to do. And because he already knows those, he does know the day when Messiah will show up. So in God's economy, it is possible to say whether Messiah will or will not show up.
Yeah, I think I'm just trying to figure out the how we say the word Messiah, but clearly it's different. And so I'm trying to understand what you mean. And you gave good examples.
And the tricky thing is, Messiah, there is nowhere in the Bible that the Messiah, it says the Messiah is going to do any. They run down the list of what Messiah is going to do. There are some things that talk about the Messiah, but they are very, very few with this kind of capital M like we think of as the ultimate Messiah. There are a ton of things to talk about Messiah, no article, no capital, kind of idea of an anointed one. So like in Daniel alone, that passage that we just read, there was an anointed one in the time that was 7 years or 49 years later. There's an anointed one that shows up. There may be a separate anointed one. There could be two anointed ones. There could be three anointed ones just on that passage alone. Is any one of those anointed ones capital M Messiah, or are they all just princes? Are they all, because every high priest is anointed. Every prince in Israel is anointed. All of these are Messiah, well, Messiahs. So this concept of the Messiah is one that had come over time to be understood through the prophets and the teachings.
Was this teaching developed post-Christ or a teaching that's always been believed that there's a Messiah every generation in Judaism?
So well, we would claim that we believe this pre-Jesus.
Okay.
But if you want to ask the academics, they'll say this is all post.
Okay.
Right. But the academics will also say Daniel wasn't written 600 years prior. That Daniel was written in the 2nd century BC. So it is an article of faith on some of these things. And so what I would, this is why I want, you know, when it came down to, well, I'm stealing your time. Go ahead.
No. So I was just trying to, the big part of your question, I was just trying to answer like.
Yeah, I got it.
Because if I just went like this, so you as a Christian, if I said, great, so Jesus comes, he arrives on the scene, and the Jews and the Gentiles accepted him as the Messiah, he'd be here, right? He wouldn't go away. Isn't that correct?
So I don't know that that's the nominal, that's the Orthodox Christian position. The Orthodox Christian position is because God sovereignly knew by middle knowledge that he would be rejected. He sent him back at that time. Why? So that the Gentiles could be drawn in and that the salvation of Israel would extend to the whole earth. After that, Israel would be brought back into the fold and all of Israel be made whole. And Paul says that, I don't want this to be a mystery to you, brothers. In the end, all Israel will be saved. And you know, we debate about what that means. But at the end of the day, that it does have to happen that way because that was, we say, quote unquote, God's plan.
No. So I get that. So I'm just asking the hypothetical. Had everybody accepted Jesus as the Messiah, he would not have left.
I don't know.
So you're asking whether there's a counterfactual
to
the counterfactual kind of thing. I would say that is, it's a logically possible world. Given God's sovereign intent, it is no longer an actualizable possible world. So I don't know.
But if that did happen, what would Jesus have done in that situation? That's the question.
If everybody accepted him.
If everybody had accepted him, what would have happened in that world?
Yeah, that is where, that's a good question.
He wouldn't have left.
He would not have come.
Yeah, I was like, he came knowing he would be rejected, knowing that he'd be the only sacrifice. And then the Holy Spirit, he says, I'm going to go so that someone better can come. So technically, when you say to a Christian, is Christ here? We could answer yes.
But still, the question is let's, obviously, Jesus had to die for atonement.
Yes.
That's
right.
What Christianity believes. Not a problem. But if everybody had accepted that at that time,
yes,
after his death, burial, and resurrection, what would have happened? The Messianic era?
So that's a good question. Let's see if I can make up something that will fit that one, because we've conquered possible worlds. That might be this. The Jewish nation says, Messiah is come, he will lead us. And Jesus begins to now instantiate, not only coming humbly as a priest, but he also begins to actualize the king thing. Now who's sitting around that doesn't like it, the Romans, and the Romans crucify him on their own without the nation of Israel saying, we reject him. He's not rejected by Israel, but he is raised by the Romans to death. He dies for atonement. Now does he have to wait? Or when the day that he's risen again, he comes back and the Romans are like, what just happened? We just crucified this guy and here he comes again. And now is he marching with 10,000 angels behind him at that time? That is to say, does the Messianic era become 3 days long and get actualized, you know, maybe that's the case. What I don't know is in that possible. So it may have been that the nation of Israel, had they not rejected him, then the kingly Messiah and the priestly Messiah would have been a week apart versus 2,000 years or whatever apart. But the reason it's hard for me to answer that question is what we're asking is for, we posit that God's knowledge failed and therefore this occurs. If that had been the case, then the Old Testament scriptures would have been written differently. So we wouldn't be dealing with the prophecies that we're dealing with now because God would have written. So my viewpoint, and if you haven't heard me say this, is God didn't say, they're going to look on him who they have pierced. And then when Yeshua is on the cross, he reaches down and puppets the centurion to be like, stick him. That's not what happened. What he does is, he, looking through time, so to speak, looking at what will happen, he says, I see the Romans will do this. Now, Isaiah, I inspire you with this, prophesy this. And so it was a counterfactual prophecy that happens across the boundaries of time that allowed these prophecies to be made. So had that been the case, the prophecies in the Old Testament wouldn't have been suffering servant and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What it would have been is atoning death and instantiation of the kingdom of God all over the whole earth. So that we would have seen in the scriptures. We would have read in the scriptures.
What was the second part of your question?
About Emmanuel.
Yeah, just the name Emmanuel then.
Emmanuel. So
divinity isn't necessary.
We would say that actually these are nothing more than, I shouldn't say nothing more, that they're theophoric names. So, like, say, for example, we have a friend named Abiad. Well, you can see that in Isaiah 9, Everlasting Father.
But aren't they named after a reality?
Yes, they are. But here's the term theophoric is a fancy academic term. What they did was, is they went and they looked at how Israelites named their children. So, like, Yeshayah, Isaiah. What does that mean? Oh, it means God saves. So it is a reality. God does save, or God does redeem. So Isaiah was named after a reality, an attribute of deity. My friend, Aviad, father of timelessness or everlasting father, that is a reality. That is a description of God. It's not a description of him. Isaiah's name is a description of God, not of him. So same thing with Emmanuel. God is with us. The Germans, of course, not to use Germans as a great example, but it serves the point. The Germans in World War I, their army had a belt buckle on it, and it said, Gott mit uns. Why were they suggesting that their soldiers were deity? No. What they were suggesting is God's on our side. Now, why would we argue that that's the specific, most reasonable, plain sense meaning of this? Is because what is talked about in Isaiah 7 is what? King Ahaz he's scared to death that the northern kingdom and Assyria are going to beat his hiney. So what happens? So God says, I'm going to give you a sign. Here's what's going to happen. This woman, she's going to get pregnant, or she is pregnant, depending upon how you'd like to work the verb. She's going to have a son. And that son is not going to be such and such an age, i.e., he's still not going to know the difference between good and evil, before I do what I've promised you, i.e., the northern kingdom and Assyria. It's over. So God with us, in this instance, would be a very similar usage as what the Germans did with the Gott mit uns. God is on our side. That's what it would play. It's not making an ontological claim about that particular individual.
And I would agree with that. And I would agree with that. The reason, I would agree with that. Almost all, I would say, there's maybe one, there's only a handful of exceptions if it's the case. Almost all Messianic prophecy is dual meaning stuff. And the rabbinic tradition acknowledges this too. Yes, it had a fulfillment in Ahaz's time. It has a fulfillment when Messiah comes. So that's why there is no case, in my opinion, by prophecy, that you can turn around and say, conclusively based on this prophecy, this is Messiah. The closest are things like, if it's the case, like I laid out today about Daniel's 70 weeks, then whoever it was, he had to have come by this time. That kind of thing. So, but you still want to add them together, because the idea is Messianic prophecy must be true in aggregate. If the Old Testament is true, these guys are right. All of it has to be fulfilled. If it's A through Z and you fill A through Y, you're not the Messiah. You got to hit Z to be the Messiah. And the point I didn't bring up in class, I thought it was a little bit of an ambush. I'll tell it now so it's not a legitimate ambush. There's a problem with Asher's position, in my opinion. of wait and see. Let's wait for Messiah to fulfill it all. Who can see what the problem is on this one? If Messiah is going to come back and lead the righteous in the battle against the wicked, what's the problem with waiting for Messiah to fulfill everything? You are either a bystander, and you're just like, eh, we'll see. Or you're part of the guys who can get swept away. So you can't actually wait until Z. You can, maybe you can wait till Y. All right, Matt, and then Dennis, and then Guy.
A couple of points. I mean, that's Pascal's wager, is that you're in the game, you've got to, you know, get one way or the other. But the question, I think, comes back to what you were talking about, sufficiency. If you have this messianic tradition that has so many facets, so many interpretations, that one might contradict the other, is there ever a position in Jewish tradition that you could arrive at sufficiency and say, yes, we can all agree on this, or whomever or whatever might come down the road will only cause more, you know, consternation or argumentation. And I think that that's where, you know, certainly in the Islam tradition with the Hadiths, is you have so many different interpretations of what it possibly could mean, you never can get a strong foundation, say, this is carved in stone, this is the accurate expectation that we have, and therefore it's kind of solidified, or it's a constitution that doesn't evolve, or, you know, it's not a living constitution, it is a static, done deal.
So can you ever arrive at a level of certitude?
Do what?
About? Can you ever arrive at a level of certitude about a particular candidate?
So it is, it's a fool's errand to try to harmonize or square the circle.
In fact, especially today, to arrive at a level of certitude, if you want to ask me where my level of certitude is personally, my level of certitude on a level of 1 through 100 or 1 through 10, 10 being the highest, I'm maybe at a 2. Maybe a 3. And I can demonstrate this, and I'll walk you to the water, and you'll drink from the very same fountain that I'm drinking from.
But wouldn't that, from a logical point of view, be an informal fallacy known as, I guess it's called slothful induction, is that at some point in time you actually have to grab onto something that is both plausible, both reasonable and logical, and you can't just advocate and wait for the open option or the open opportunity to somehow get you across the line to 10.
My question is right along the line of his, which is, at what point does it just simply become intellectually disingenuous to look at the evidence and to say, you know what, I don't care. You know, he was born in Bethlehem, scourged, hung on a tree, 30 pieces of silver, buried in a rich man's tomb, all these very specific prophecies that weed out all of humanity and leave us with one person. So at what point do we simply say, you know what, I don't care. I'm just not going to acknowledge that Jesus is the Christ, even when we add on top of that the evidence supporting him rising from the dead, which is, hey, admit it, it's a huge credibility builder there, if you can do that. So at what point, where's the threshold in historic rabbinical Judaism where they say, hey, you know what, all this stuff for Jesus, we discount it because of X. Now, I want to know, what is the disqualifier for this person, Jesus, that a lot of the people in this room say, hey, we believe this guy is the Messiah, he fulfilled all these prophecies, we believe that the evidence is there for him rising from the dead, but for some reason, he's disqualified in your minds. And I'm just curious, what is that disqualifier? I haven't heard that yet. Maybe I stepped out of class on that.
So I'm going to start with the first part that you spoke about, and I'm going to do it this way. Is it okay if I stand?
Yes, sir. I don't want to hurt you.
I didn't think mine was a multi-part question.
Yeah.
No. So
if you get fired up enough, it's a done deal. Okay.
Actually, I forgive Guy for jumping in ahead of me because I was next.
I apologize.
No, I know it's...
Well, very Christian of you, Dennis. Thank you.
So in Judaism, we're known for answering a question with a question. So at
no
what
way.
Point?
I know somebody who did that.
It was all related.
So I'm going to flip it. So at what point? Let's say that I bring a candidate. He just walks through the door here, and he comes up here, and he writes down everything that he's fulfilled in the Hebrew Bible. He now actualizes everything. He goes, hey, here's the newspapers. Hey, by the way, since you guys were inside, I had the temple rebuilt in Jerusalem and everything, and on and on and on and on. At what point do you go, Jesus isn't the Messiah and he is?
Would you?
Would you?
At that point, would you?
At that point, you as a Christian, would you now, or are you going to take William Lane Craig's saying, where William Lane Craig says, even if the entire consensus of academic scholarship flies against Jesus, because I have the witness of the Holy Spirit, I'm staying in Christianity. So that's what you asked me. So I'm now flipping the tables.
Well, I actually and he loves it. Yeah. Qualifier.
No.
If I hear correctly in your statement, your disqualifier is that Jesus hasn't fulfilled all of the prophecies.
No, it's not that. You misunderstand. Do you mind if I...
Go ahead.
Here's what I have to write. Asher has to stand. I have to write. No, it's okay. No.
Everybody writing on the wall.
So...
I think now is the time for me to finally announce that I am the Messiah.
There you go.
So welcome to stand up on the board and write those prophecies.
So you'll notice what Scott said, I agree with, and he did this at the very beginning regarding messianic prophecies. Here's the deal. If you were to just read the Old Testament alone, you wouldn't say any of those are messianic. Where do you get the idea in the first place that they're messianic? Where?
Oh, is that a question?
Genesis 3:15. Where you get it's messianic.
Where? Right. In the text itself.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that's a reasonable approach. In fact, when Jesus is talking to the people on the road to Emmaus, I think it was, and they're all upset. And then he comes to them and says, hey, wait a minute. Let me go ahead and explain the prophecies to you. And he starts at Moses and works his way on through. And all of a sudden, they... who didn't believe in him up until that point, they start to go, hey, wait a minute. The Jewish interpretation, and we see it in Mark 14, where the Jewish leaders have said, hey, are you the Messiah? And Jesus says, yes, I am. And they go, you're wrong. That's blasphemy. You know, you don't fit with our interpretation of what we think the Messiah should be. So here's Jesus coming on the road to Emmaus. These guys are saying, hey, our guy died, and, you know, he obviously didn't qualify. And Jesus starts to explain to them, here are the prophecies fulfilled. Here's the way it should properly be interpreted.
But that didn't answer my question. Why do you believe Isaiah 7 is messianic? You, personally, based on Isaiah.
Well, his point is...
My point is retroactive. Simply this.
Right. It's because you believe the guy.
Right.
I get you. Yep. Because you believe the guy, then you're making the claim that therefore this is this way. I hear you.
Yeah,
that's what Mormons do all the time to me. Every time I talk to a Mormon, they do the exact same thing.
That's why I'm wondering if we're on a dead-end approach. Because
the Mormons are
trying to take...
Who knew?
Here's a great equalizer, because the point is a good question. Hey, look, there's an awful lot of evidence, even retroactively. Let's say retroactively. There's an awful lot of evidence. If the idea is that the prophecies were to people to read them retroactively, what's wrong with that? Maybe that was the case.
No problem.
Okay, but now the question is, what's the standard? All right, we've turned the question around. Well, if the question is, what's the standard, what about you? What if somebody had come into the room and said, temple's rebuilt, I just conquered the world, we're living in righteousness, go outside, the lambs are laying down with the lions. If our answer is not, and I don't know that Craig would answer it the way that you're... the way that you would say there. Maybe he would. But I would say this. I would say that's a really, really good evidence. They would change how my intuition fits. And if that's the case, I need to seriously consider that Yeshua is not Messiah, that this guy is. Now let's go look at the evidence. So you absolutely should that challenge you to look and say, but this guy, and you say, where did you fulfill the rest of these things? And then he outlines to you, this wasn't actually messianic prophecy. You guys read that back in. Let me show you the prophecies. And by the way, remember, we were trying to get to Z. We're at Z. In that case, I'd probably have to say this guy's a Messiah. Now, this is still fiction, so my question question back is this. What about the resurrection?
Yeah, but hold on, one thing at a time. First off, you listed the messianic prophecies first.
Sure.
That's why I'm aiming at those. Mm-hmm. On its own, you couldn't come up with a messianic prophecy as if your life depended on it. That's the facts, Jack.
Well, actually, I could.
Good, great. You show me a prophecy where...
All
right, great. Where it says Messiah, what's the verse?
Sure. So when... Herod says to...
No, I want the Old Testament. Old Testament. I want the Old Testament. I don't care about the New Testament. That doesn't count. That's like the Book of Mormon. All right, so Micah 5:2.
And in the New Testament, and I think it's only fair not to put my opinion against your opinion
right.
about what's messianic, but to put the first century Jews who were living at that time, their impression of what was a messianic prophecy against the Old Testament. So when Herod says
hold on.
To...
Wait, one just question, though.
You asked for a messianic prophecy.
All right, yes. I want a messianic prophecy. Sure. So you believe Micah 5:2?
Right. So when Herod says to the Jewish teachers, he calls them in and says, hey, I got these guys who came in, they want to go worship the Messiah. Where is the Messiah supposed to be born? And the Jewish leaders at that time, the teachers of the law, said, oh, he's going to be born in Bethlehem. So that was their impression mm-hmm. of a messianic prophecy.
Okay, so because of...
We have said earlier that...
There's one that Jesus...
They could have it wrong, just because somebody back in the day was like, we're Jews,
so
this is what
we say. Jew said that's where Messiah is going to be born. So let's look at Micah.
But we're talking about the teachers. We're not talking about some
teacher.
Idiot.
Some teacher. The Pope told me something. So the Pope, who is... Let's face it, he's the head of the largest Christian denomination on the planet. 1.2 billion Christians. The Pope, Pope Francis. So if I go and ask him something, you're telling me that because he's a leader, he's right?
You got to be careful with this. Because my response to this would be, no, wait a minute. Are you saying the people who are the holders of the Jewish tradition in first century Christianity... that they were not right about the Jewish tradition?
They can be wrong.
No, we've already acknowledged.
Guy at a minimum, the great council of the greatest rabbis at the time concluded Jesus wasn't the Messiah. So if we're going to stand on the position to say, if the Jew said it at the time, then the Jew is right, then Messiah is automatically disqualified as Yeshua.
Right, but I'm not saying that they said Jesus was the Messiah. I'm just saying that they said that according to
the principle you're laying out is back in the day, if they say it's Messiah, messianic prophecy. Sorry,
see the difference?
I was talking over you. I apologize. I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, we were both talking.
But the principle you've laid out is this: the Jewish teacher at the time could not have been wrong. Thus, this is messianic prophecy. So either it's the case that he could have been wrong, in which case you may be wrong about the prophecy, or it's a case that he couldn't have been wrong, in which case Jesus isn't Messiah. But you're on the horns of that dilemma.
Yeah,
perhaps we should let
why don't you answer his candidates. Question?
You said that Micah 5:2 was a messianic prophecy.
Yes.
You're claiming that because some Jewish leaders said so in the first century, correct? Because there are a lot of different Jewish leaders. There's Sadducees, there's Pharisees, there's Essenes. So some Jewish leader, do we know which group, which denomination he was from? I don't know why.
So forget that. Let's make it a little more pointed.
Yeah.
Guy, do you think that there is a verse in there that regardless of whether you're Sadducee, Essene, Pharisee, random Gentile, that is very clear that says the Messiah will do this?
He said,
like, what's the most clear messianic prophecy? You think that's the most clear in the whole of the Old Testament?
Oh, I think there might be others, but I just picked that one because it was referenced by the leaders that time as being a messianic prophecy about where the Messiah will be born. I mean, is there better evidence that we're looking for than the king coming to the leaders of the holders of the Jewish tradition
let me take this one. Now, unfortunately, someone's going to have to give me the yarmulke because I'm on the dead side of this. Micah 5. But you, O Bethlehem, so I'm reading it. But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who were too little to be among the clans of Judah. A couple ways to translate that. From you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore, he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. Then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel, and he shall stand and shepherd the flock in the strength of the Lord, and the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And he shall dwell secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be their peace. When the Assyrian comes into our land and treads in our palaces, then we will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 princes of men. They shall shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword, the land of Nimrod at its entrances, and he shall deliver us from Assyria. When he comes into our land and treads within our border, where is Assyria today? The nation of Assyria is gone. This prophecy cannot be anymore because Assyria as a nation was destroyed. The land is still there, but there is no Assyria. The Assyrians are gone. There are Syrians now, but that's a different people group than the Assyrians. This prophecy, as it is told in context, already has to have come true with the raising of a king of Israel. So not only does it not say, by the way, the word Mashiach appears nowhere in here. So this one was cited and is understood to be a messianic prophecy, but it like almost all of them, is dual use. Both the rabbinic tradition and the Christian tradition.
And so here's the dilemma. With that?
The problem is this. And so your question of standards. What's the standard? Their question, right. Their answer is actually correct if. If you're going to say, let's say that everybody in the world, every rabbi in the world magically came to consensus of which verses were messianic and which were not. They don't. We don't. Christians don't agree on them all. But if everybody agreed, the answer to who's the Messiah is the one that fulfills them all. Is it the case that Yeshua has not fulfilled them all today? Univocally, every Christian on earth that studies it has to come to the conclusion Jesus has not fulfilled all of the prophecies yet. So if the question is, it's 100% or it's none, that's correct. Now the question is,
is that?
And
the question is that the standard? But right. here's the idea, and my opinion would be this. God knows this, right? So God, if he's trying to clue his people in to this is who Messiah is, can give them hints. He can do one of three things. He can either say, Isaiah, write the following. Messiah will come in the year, 30 A.D., whatever, and explain what A.D. is to him, by the way. Yeah? We'll come in 30 A.D. We'll come in exactly this number of years, which maybe you say, well, he kind of did that to Daniel. If you want to be that clear in Daniel, what he could have said was this. 70 weeks are appointed for your people. All these things are going to happen. The Messiah will arise. He will atone for the sin of the nation of Israel. He will die on the cross by crucifixion by the Romans. They're going to list it out in the nth detail and make it very clear. God could have done it that way. One way of doing it. Another way of doing it, God keeps it kind of mysterious. It happens, and then those that he wants to, who want to find him, will find this, and those that he doesn't won't. All right? The third way to do it is to say, by hints. The third way to do it is give hints, and then there has to be a sign so powerful that it's irrefutable. And that's what I think the resurrection is. And that's why I want to know what y'all's answer is to the resurrection. Because to me, it does kind of boil down to that. When I talked to Dennis, my major point, see, look, the eyes are already rolling up. So he knows where I'm going with this, which is that the minimum facts approach to the resurrection is everybody agrees with these, what's the best idea? We're actually beyond the minimal facts because we agree the resurrection occurred. Now the question is, what does it mean? So I'm going to say divinity claims of Christ, God raised him from the dead. Why?
So let me just, one point to you, and then I'm going to give the time back to Asher. It's just one quick thing. I actually agree with Scott. I agree that when he said, hey, we agree on what constitutes messianic verses, but here's the deal. That doesn't mean crap. Not one thing. Because why? That means we have the tradition that told us that these were messianic verses in the first place. Maybe we're wrong. We, as a community, the Pharisaic community, maybe we're wrong. So if you had to prove it, this is why Asher talked about cherry picking, so to speak. If you had to actually demonstrate that Micah 5 was messianic, you'd have to go to rabbinic literature. But you're going to have to, when you do that, you're going to be cherry picking how you deal with the rabbinic literature that you're using to justify your interpretation. But it still isn't sufficient. And the reason it's not sufficient is you have to do one more thing. You have to say, actually, they got it right. I grant rabbinic Judaism that there is this tradition that they have held for thousands of years since Moses about what constitutes messianic verses. Just me going, because let me tell you what this is akin to. This would be me saying, well, I'm going to figure out how Christians have understood the New Testament. And I'm going to go to, I always use the Mormons as an example. I'm going to go to Mr. Mormon here, Elder Jones, and say, Elder Jones, in your Christian denomination, how do you guys understand this? Well, see, there are Christians, the Mormons here, who look at the experience in Genesis as God talking about having have a body. He's walking. That's what they believe. But are they right? Would that justify me saying that's what Genesis is teaching? Only if I acknowledge that they're right in the first place. But to use rabbinic literature, which is why Asher said, in a sense, cherry picking, Christianity is built, in essence, if I put it in a broad brushstroke, on the back of rabbinic Judaism. Necessarily so. If rabbinic Judaism is wrong, Christianity is false.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going with this, is that I'm wondering if this is a dead-end argument or a process, because if we get to the end of this and we say, you know what, the Christian impression of who Jesus is doesn't fit into your particular beliefs about who the Messiah should be, isn't that the same as saying that Jesus' impression 2,000 years ago of who the Messiah should be didn't fit into the rabbinic traditions held by the high priests and the teachers of the law, and etc.? I mean, aren't we left with the same problem?
No, because here's the issue, that, and this is what Asher brought up last time. There is more than one way to understand the New Testament. If you're a rabbinic Jew and you were to pick up the New Testament, you would not end up with mainstream Christianity today. That's the point that he was trying to make. So,
And I agree with that.
So the real dilemma is this. If you can't use rabbinic Judaism unless you grant its authenticity. So therefore, all of these messianic prophecies that you claim are messianic, you're wrong. Already, you're de facto, you're wrong.
Right.
You couldn't prove it worth crud. And the demonstration of this is, look at the scholars when they're dealing with Isaiah or Ezekiel or Jeremiah. When they're looking at the text in its historical context, they don't come up with Messiah at all. And I agree with them. They shouldn't. There's no reason to. It's only by virtue of rabbinic Judaism that you get that idea, which is why he mentioned cherry picking. So really then, the answer is what he said. Ultimately, it would be a sign that is so obvious, which is why he had used the example of world peace, sin ending, no death, temple rebuilt. Those are so obvious, that would be it. Until then, it is actually reasonable to go, yeah, we have a lot of potential messiahs. And so that was the point.
Okay, so you're disqualified. Dennis, do you want to ask a question?
No, no.
No, it's not that he's disqualified.
I didn't disqualify.
From your arm here.
Because I ignore him so much, he feels he has to. That's probably
fair. Is your question answered?
No, it's okay. I mean, I'm getting as much
as possible. Yeah, and it's not that he's disqualified. We just don't know. Like, for him, he asked this. He goes, you know, I don't think it's good to sit and wait and, you know, find out who it is. Well, that's because in his system, belief in the Messiah is such a big thing. So this is from a Jewish prayer book, and it's called Sidur Tehillat Hashem. And basically, if you want to know, if somebody asks me, what does Orthodox Judaism teach as a theology, I'll give you a Jewish prayer book with commentary in it and so on, and it'll basically tell you. So this is the beginning of what's called Berkat HaMazon, the blessings or grace after meals. So you'll see Jesus doing this in the New Testament, by the way. Now, you're not going to see him read out this whole thing, but it's going to say that after he ate, and before he ate, he blessed the food, and so on, right? So this is how it opens up. So let's see the difference between our theologies. Messiah, big, important, so on, or this theology. This is how it opens up. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise is always in my mouth. Ultimately, all is known. Get ready. Fear God and observe his commandments, for this is the whole purpose of man. Not Messiah, not anything else. That's the whole purpose of man. Fear God and observe his commandments. So in rabbinic literature, we have this saying. So you're planting a tree. We hear Joe say, the Messiah has arrived. Everybody, quick, come down to the town. He's arrived. He's here. Rabbinic literature says, continue planting the tree. Finish that off. Then you go and greet the Messiah. The moral of the story is okay, the idea is great. Maybe he's the Messiah, maybe he isn't. But do what you finish off what you were completing doing, and that's going to be the difference between us.
So why do you, I don't understand the difference between us based on that.
Oh, because the issue would be is for mainstream Christianity.
Yeah.
In general, it's the Messiah that's the central thing.
So
for Judaism,
I think I
it's
what you're saying,
the coming of the Messiah.
Yeah, I care nothing for mainstream Christianity.
No, I understand, but that's just what he's generally that's what he's referencing.
Fair enough. So what I will say is this:
we die on tape.
This is what Jesus backs exactly that. He says, whoever, in the kingdom of heaven, whoever teaches and people to obey the least of these commandments will be called greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever teaches people to disobey these commandments will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. I tell you the truth, that not one jot or tittle will disappear from the law. The heaven and earth will vanish before the law vanishes. So I would say that's, mainstream Christianity I don't care about. Is Messiah important? Messiah is important. Why do I believe in Messiah as important? Because Messiah is the end of atonement. Because I believe the prophets. Because I believe the Psalms and the writings. Because I believe the law. I believe the law.
And I don't deny any of those things.
Of course not. But I mean to say...
But it's the priority.
Messiah is important to me only because Messiah is God's method for fixing... Messiah is plan B. Plan A is don't fall in the first place, so to speak. Adam doesn't... God built paradise... Adam doesn't fall. Great. Now that happens, now Messiah is plan B. That's why Messiah is important to me. But if no prophets, then I wouldn't be looking for Messiahs. God, I believe in Messiah because I believe in the prophets. I believe in the prophets because I believe in the miracles that have happened. I believe in the miracles because I believe in the history and the archaeology. And I believe in these things because I see the work in my own life. So that's it all comes together for me there. To me, Messiah teaches what you just taught. Sorry, Dennis. And then back to Asher to answer that one. His arm's gonna fall.
What?
Yeah,
it's your turn.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Are you gonna interrupt me?
I'm gonna try not to.
I want Asher to answer that, and then please come back to me.
Okay.
So, if the Messiah is so important, as you say, and it's fascinating. So we're taught in the academy when you write. That you
the
do
academy
it with first levels of importance.
The academy is in Colorado Springs.
Yeah, that's true. Good.
So in college, university, you're at George Mason, right?
I'm not.
Oh, no. I forgot where you're doing your bachelor's degree.
Shepherd. It's really
okay. So when you took your writing class, they taught you to write with, when you're getting out your idea, what is first most important, second most important, third most important, and so on. That's generally how they teach that in the university. So it's fascinating that if the Messiah is at such an important level, okay, so let's start with Joshua, and we'll start going through all the prophets. And boy, it's not clear. But the one thing that we do see is clear is fear God. And obey his commandments. Fear God, obey his commandments. Fear God, obey his commandments. So I don't deny you that the Messiah is important, but the level of where you place them, Messiah being here versus here,
But what did the Messiah come and teach? He came and taught. Not only, you have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you, not only do that, not only obey the law, you guys are undergunning what the spirit of what God meant by this one. Don't even look at a woman lustfully. You have heard it said, do not kill, but I say to you, anybody who's angry with his brother is guilty before the court, and whoever says to his brother, Raka, is guilty before the high court, etc. And so he doubles down on the law and says not only is Torah important, Torah in its infinitesimally focused intent is important. He came to uphold the law. He says, I've not come, do not think I've come to abolish the law. I've come to fulfill the law. And by fulfill, he just doesn't just mean it all pointed to me as Messiah. He said, you will teach people to observe these things. That's the first part of the greatest commandment is teach them to observe all that I've commanded you. And his commandments were the commandments that were in Torah. They were Moses' commandments with even more on top of it. He doesn't have 613 laws. He's got 1,000. So Messiah brought us more law, not less. But he also brought us atonement and freedom, and not freedom from the law, freedom from sin. That's the difference. So I think part of the problem is, and I can certainly see, if I'm sitting in these guys' shoes or maybe under these guys' yarmulkes, I would say I can see why Christianity would give them the wrong impression. But my impression is that's not what Messiah taught.
All right, that's enough.
Okay.
4 points.
You're the one that opened the door on that one, man.
4 points now because things have been added to since that first time. First of all, you said that the Germans in World War I had what on their belts?
World War II.
World War II.
God with us.
I did say World War I. It was me. I know we Jews look alike, but.
That's why they were the different.
I remember Dennis and Jew.
I know. That's why I figured he'd enjoy the joke.
I told a very good friend of mine that I was a Jew. I'd known him for 20 years. You know what the first thing out of his mouth was?
A laugh?
No. He looked at me and he said, "You don't look Jewish." Now, who says that?
Right. Well,
that's the dumbest thing ever. I
should pick your friends more carefully.
Second, you just said that man should not look at women lustfully.
Actually, Jesus said that, but I repeated it.
Okay. Would it be wrong for a woman to look at a man lustfully?
Yes, that's the implication.
That's the implication?
Yeah. Fortunately, I've yet to meet a man good enough for any woman with a rational mind to look at lustfully. That's a joke. Go ahead.
Third, I've been listening to this for years now, and we have two Jews in here who know their stuff backwards and forwards.
Yes.
We've got a Christian who claims he knows his stuff.
Actually, I claim the opposite. I claim to be a layman, and don't miss that point. By the way, in case you're wondering,
I'm not finished talking.
I am an expert in nothing, so your point is mistaken, but go ahead.
Does anybody here own a gun?
Yes, I do, unfortunately.
I was going to say shoot him, but shoot me. So I've been listening to this for 7-8 years now. I've been listening to this. And what comes down to an atheist is, no matter who you are, you can make a case for your religion. If a Hindu walked in here tomorrow, he could make a case for his. The thing is, you each believe what you believe based on your scripture, and you can make a case for it. You're never going to talk these people, Asher and Effie. That's my first girlfriend's name.
Not the same. Full name.
Well, she was Effie. I called her Effie. You're never going to convince the people in this room that you're right.
So
never. The people, wait, do it.
When you say this, Dennis, this is what you said this the other day. I cannot let you get away with this, and here's why. Christian who became an atheist. Guy who became a Christian and then became a Jew. So, I mean, sitting in the room, not only do you know people, and Jeremiah, a Jew who became a Christian, like, they're all here, including you. So even if these guys were lying to you, you know yourself that people can be talked in and out of beliefs. Why? What possible justification do you have for that to be true?
Are you finished?
In the form of a question. What possible justification do you have for that
to be true? It's my question time, not yours.
Cathedra, may I? Regular.
And these, you're never going to convince them that they're wrong. So, to an atheist, it's all this. It's all a game. For all these religions, it's all a game. To us, it's a game. I listen to Scott, and he says all this stuff. I listen to you guys, and you say all this stuff. And it's all a game.
Okay, fair enough.
To me.
Fair enough. Your point can be answered in a way that I think is compelling.
They have I'm a case. Hear it from them.
They have a case.
I've heard your answer.
We're all on the same team, brother, so I'm them right
no,
now.
No, you're not.
On this case, I am. In this case, we believe there's a case to be made for God. Make the case that there is no God. Go.
We're going to be here.
Floor is yours. Make the case.
I'm listening to you, Scott. I want to hear their case.
We have one question, sir. Since he Asher will ask.
I want to hear their case for why I'm wrong to believe that it's all a game.
Why are you wrong to believe that this is all a game? Is that your question?
Yes. What is your answer to an atheist when he says, "You got all these religions. How many religions have there been since the birth of man? Thousands. Thousands of gods. Thousands of deities. Why is yours right? Why is his right? Why are the Hindus right? Why are the whoever's right? What about all the religions you've never heard of? Which one is right and why?"
Okay. So this is how I will answer this. One is because God is important to me, and so that's why I go through this. Even though my certitude level may be at a 2, still, God is important to me.
I understand.
If God were not important to me, let me tell you what happens. So we all live here in the United States of America, and I'm going to ask him, do you believe that we have rights?
Yes.
And who gave us these rights?
God
gave us these rights. If we really
Constitution had nothing to do with it?
No, this is the Declaration of Independence. So the Declaration of Independence says that we are given these rights. So here's going to be my thing for you. I fight for America because I believe that God gave us these rights. If this is not true, then we are nothing but stardust, and I'm taking off my jacket, and there can be whatever there's going to be. It's just going to be bad for whatever. So Effie here can decide that he can now violate what I believe that the Declaration of Independence says, that I have God-given rights. He can't violate these things. I'm willing to fight for these things to say yes. In fact, this is what's so funny to me. When people discuss why the West has this issue in the Middle East, so Islam, say for example, they shoot rockets, they bomb, they do whatever, and it's all in the name of what? Religion, right? Well, my answer always to my Muslim friends is quite simply this. We are bombing Israel or the United States or so on is not bombing them for religious reasons. We are bombing them for the very simple reason is we are trying to maintain our way of life. We don't want ISIS running through here in the United States of America because we believe that the Declaration of Independence gives us these God-given human rights. I believe that women have a right to vote. Do you believe that?
As of 1920, I have to.
No, not, but forget that you have to. Do you actually believe that women have a right to vote and that God gave them a voice?
Before 1920, they couldn't.
But he's asking, what do you believe, not to what the law says?
I believe women should rule the world. Listen, that, say America never existed.
So that this is why this is not a game. Yeah, great, so America never existed. No problem. Then some other government existed.
What makes... That's not an answer to my question. Is what makes Judaism right? What makes Christianity right? What makes Hinduism right?
Reality.
To an atheist, it's... You all claim you're right.
Well, to an atheist, we're all nothing but stardust.
Well, no, and what
and we're just bumping into each other.
Well, no, I got an answer. Listen. Everybody in this room is an atheist. I just go one God further.
That's not the way.
There's thousands of religions.
I'm quoting somebody, but I'm not quite sure I understand that.
It's a common.
It doesn't matter. It's right.
Okay. I don't. I was just saying. I don't get what you're saying.
Yeah.
You're an atheist as far as every other religion is concerned.
Now, atheist means you don't believe in a God.
Theist, that's God, so... Amen. I don't believe in Hinduism. We can go through it line by line. So you can't say I'm an atheist, though, because that would disqualify my religion. I do believe in
it. I say you're an atheist. I just go one God further.
I understand what you're trying to say. I'm just saying it doesn't work out when you actually sparse the words. But it's a...
So Dennis, your question is a good one. Why do we think we're right? Why do you think you're right?
So let me do it this way. I believe that I can make a credible case for Hinduism. Do I believe that am I a Hindu?
No.
But I believe that I can make a credible case for Hinduism. However, I disagree with them based on a ton of things, presuppositions, tradition, and so on. I believe that I can make a very good case for Buddhism as well. Now, Scott doesn't like Buddhism and so on. He has his issues with it. I also have my issues with Buddhism as well. But I get it that to you this is a game, but to those people that are involved in this, all the world religions, especially if they're theistic primarily, which is what makes them a world religion, if they're theistic, we all start from a common starting point. And that's what we would all agree on, and that's why this is not a game to us. Now, then from there it's going to go through this trajectory of things. So is God a personal God, an impersonal God? Is he a multiplicity? Is he single? Whatever. We can walk through this whole thing. And the reason why we do that is because we care. That's why.
A Hindu could come in here and do the same thing. He could stand where you are and say,
you're right.
I could make a case for Judaism, but I don't believe it. I believe I'm right. So to this atheist, it's what?
Well, an atheist comes into this classroom and they can make a good case for atheism.
Actually, they can't. The one exception is everybody. The only one that can't is an atheist.
They can try to make a case for atheism, and they can say that they could make a case for Christianity, but they don't believe it, like all the people who have gone from Christianity to atheism. And why is it that atheists are in this special category?
Don't pick on the guy to your right.
They're exempt. Why aren't you included in the game? That's my question.
Because atheism is not a faith. Atheism is the absence of faith.
It's a faith. Oh,
you believe. But you asked, I
believe that there is no God of any kind because I don't see the evidence for it. I don't say that the Hindu God, the Jewish God, I don't say they don't exist. I don't say that. I say that I see no evidence for it, so I don't believe in it. But that's not the same thing as saying there is no such thing as God.
When you say no,
but he's asking you, why are you involved in the game?
Right.
I have no freaking idea why. Okay. I'm seriously.
Now, we believe we know why you're involved in the game. We believe because you're created in the image of God, and that's why you're here.
Burn.
Uh-oh.
I seriously don't get that.
Let me ask this question. When you say there is no evidence for God at all, do you really believe no evidence?
Okay, I know. There is no evidence that convinces me.
Right. Okay. But you have been convinced that there is no God.
No, I didn't say that.
Do you believe in a God?
No.
So you are convinced as of right now that there is no God.
I see no evidence, so there's no reason for me to believe in a God. So
I don't know that that's the case. The reasons we've laid out for you is there is a universe. That's a reason.
I don't buy your reason. I don't buy your evidence. I'm allowed to do that.
You are.
Declaration of Independence.
Can you do that?
I'm allowed to do that.
You certainly are. But the question is, can you do that logically consistently?
I think.
Now, what I would say is this. These guys can make a case for why this is true. We can make a case for why this is true. Make a case that that there is no God.
Do you, Asher, Effie, do you believe that the Messiah, when he comes, is going to be the Son of God?
Actually, I want you to answer my question.
Screw your questions, guys. No, I don't have to.
You've gotten up to, in the name of atheism, just make a case for atheism. A simple one. Actually, offer me a single piece of evidence. One piece.
Does Judaism
the reason you don't do it,
the Messiah has to be the Son of God?
Asher, go ahead.
Yes, we believe that the term Son of God is a messianic title.
Okay. I always thought that Messiah just meant like a good guy, a savior, a guy who's going to do good. And that, but you actually believe that he's going to be the Son of God. He's going to be divine.
No, not that he's going to be divine.
Oh, what?
So the term
Son
of God.
They believe Jesus was divine.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Why is your Messiah not going to be divine?
Why is he not going to be divine? Because we don't find any evidence for him being divine.
There's nothing that says he will be.
Right.
What?
There's nothing in the scripture.
You're not going to find anything that says he will be divine. It is, as Scott earlier said, you know, I am. It is implied from a verse, but there's nothing in the Old Testament that's going to say
this Messiah will be
divine. Or anything about Messiah.
So one of you guys is wrong.
Right.
Definitely.
We kind of said that.
Dennis, you're asking something of religion that you don't ask of in science. Because how many theories, I'll ask the question back, how many theories of science have there been out there since the foundation of the world? How many people agree right now? You can find anybody who says this and anybody who says that, even within naturalism and Darwinism, they disagree.
Tell you one thing, science,
but yet you believe in it.
I'll tell you one thing science has going for it. It never says that it knows the truth.
It always says it knows the truth. Never says, for every time, Lawrence Krauss said, we now know, fill in the blank with something.
It never says that it knows that it is always changing. Newton's law, it's
always
at the time
we don't build science from the ground up. We haven't started with principles that we discovered thousands of years ago and built it up forward.
Science is always looking for why its theories are wrong, and it builds on it, and it builds on it, and it builds on it.
No, science,
you guys are never going to change.
You do not know anything about how science is actually executed if you believe your own.
I was going to say, actually, having done science, whenever you're in the field, you're pretty much trying to confirm science,
you're trying to disprove it.
No.
You make hypotheses.
Yes. We're out trying to figure out which genes control things genes control traits. We're trying to prove how this does this to prove that it does do that thing. It's all confirmational. It's exciting when we find out that it's wrong.
That's where you make your name.
Right.
That's where you make your name when you find
it. But whenever you're doing science, you're trying to confirm it.
Scott claims that the theory of relativity or Einstein was wrong. If he could prove that, he's the new Newton.
This is where you don't... It's not me. Go read any of the physics literature today. Every physicist in the world believes that. It's not just me.
They're all trying to prove something's wrong. If they can prove it's wrong, it makes them. That's how they make their bones.
Again, that is completely not true. Einstein said, I stood on the shoulders of giants. That's why I got there. He is standing on Newton and Lorentz and Maxwell.
Yes, he built on them. And somebody's going to build on Einstein. Well,
that just completely counters what you just said.
It doesn't.
You just said the guy who destroys everything before him is the way that makes
it. No, if somebody comes along and proves Darwin's evolution theory by natural selection is wrong, that's a monster.
But if they prove it's true, that's pretty exciting too. Then they're going to be super famous.
They've already pretty much done it's true.
Dennis.
James, come on. Even you know it's...
No, when you say, like, if you're saying proof evolution, I would want to see, like, they took a something with a high reproduction rate and then did it for a really long time without adding information, and it turned into some drastically different species. And I think that would be...
You're never going to prove anything is absolutely true. Never.
So our evolution.
So faith is needed.
What about that statement?
You have faith in science.
Hold on. Do you think that evolutionary biologists literally go out there and they're like, I'm going to do an experiment to prove that evolutionary biology is false? Every single one of them is going out there to confirm the theory.
Hundreds have tried to prove that it is false and they fail. Let me ask you, do you guys believe in evolution?
This is polemics and completely
unrelated. Do you guys believe in evolution? As Darwin posited it.
Some of us believe in theistic evolution.
Which is?
What you and I have talked about.
Which is what, actually?
Which is that God put in process those things that Darwin observed.
And when did it, was Luca?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not a scientist, so.
Okay, I gotta go.
But
yeah. I'm glad you're all atheists now, so.
I have another question.
Yeah, sure.
So, can you explain to me your vision of heaven?
Say it again.
Of, like, your vision of heaven, or your view of heaven and what it is and what's there?
I would have to look in the literature to actually tell you.
Really? Like, do you dream about heaven? You can just tell me what you think.
No, it's not something that I ever looked into.
Really?
Yeah. So say, for example, if I ask you right now, in heaven? Is your dog going to be in heaven with you?
Yes.
All dogs?
Popular Christian conception of heaven falls
into that.
Wait,
what's
that?
The perfect
popular,
animals aren't there.
The popular Christian conception of heaven falls in the same category. I'll do the Dennis thing since he's gone. Let me ask a poll. How many people believe they're going to heaven when they die? Okay. How many people know that Christianity teaches that you don't go to heaven when you die?
Wait, repeat that again.
Christianity does not teach that you go to heaven when you die.
But you'll be in the presence of God.
You'll be in the presence of God, but what is your long-term destiny? To live in heaven?
No,
new heaven and a new earth. Now, this is, depending on how you define it, you can say, well, that will be heaven. But it's not heaven like the normal, most people are like harps and wings and bright robes.
Nobody
clouds.
In this room, but okay.
Right, not in this room, but the bottom line is, if you ask a Christian for a specific position of heaven, and you split us up like cops do, you might get as many different understandings of heaven as you have people in this room.
I know. Easy. I just wanted to know these gentlemen's view of heaven, and I guess I can be more specific. Is there an eternity with God in your spectrum of life? I don't even know how to say
it. Yes.
Okay, so ultimately there is an eternal presence with God.
Yeah, okay. And that actually ultimately everything gets rectified, and I'm going to use this metaphor that they usually talk about, that we are all chips off of a block,
yeah.
And that we will all be returned to that block.
So the Garden of Eden would be restored.
The term would be used, the Garden of Eden. Whether you're talking about the literal or not, that's, again, getting
right,
a good description.
Right, yeah, I don't care about that.
Because really, for Jews, really what it is how we live our lives now. That's really what's important. The afterlife, it's true. There are beliefs out there regarding the afterlife. But they are not as clearly defined as some might think they are, say, in Christianity. Because I could go to some Christians and they'd give me a whole story, detail and everything. Right. We usually don't go that far. Because it's the here and now.
So what confused me is when last time we talked, you mentioned reincarnation. So I'm confused. Can you help me clarify how that works?
So the way that it works is kind of like this. So I pass away. Mm-hmm. I go to heaven, actually, before the great throne of judgment. Mm-hmm. And I have angels on one side, angels on the other side. So accusing angels and defending angels. The accusing angels, and I don't get any say. The accusing angels are going to do their job. The defending angels are going to do their job. God, or whoever his region is going to make a judgment on me. And then one of several things will happen. Either A, I go to Gehenna, in which I go through this period of, like, what they would call purgatory.
Okay.
And I go through, like, a purgatory. Another one will be that I go straight to heaven, like, to be with God eternally or so on and until the resurrection and that business.
Gehenna is the exact same term in the New Testament.
Yeah, I recognize it.
That is translated hell.
Oh, so that's not purgatory.
Well, yes, it is. Talk to the Catholic next to you.
And then the other one is that I could be judged that I get reincarnated. And then my reincarnation could be either an inanimate object, something that animate, or into like an animal, human being, or so on.
And what would be the hierarchy of the reincarnation? Like a rock, would that be desirable?
That's the lowest.
Oh.
a human being is the highest.
Oh, okay.
Inanimate is the lowest. Then there's vegetative, animal, rational. Rational being human.
If you're a rock, how could you possibly progress?
How could you progress if you're incarnated, if you're reincarnated into a rock?
Because you don't die.
Metamorphosis and sedimentation.
Yeah. That element, I don't know. So, or a tree or whatever have you. I don't know how you can progress.
Okay.
I just know that that's the state that you are put in until you're released from that.
Okay. So interesting. I've never been able to understand what Judaism believes, so thank you very much.
Quick follow-up. Well, you guys can qualify too, the same way. I don't ever understand what Christianity believes. All right, some issues there. This is, there are portions of Judaism that would say this is too mystical. There are portions of Judaism that is not mystical enough. So there's a spectrum here. The agreement that I think that I would at least affirm of what these guys said is, this is Rabbinic Judaism at the time of Jesus. Very similar. I wouldn't say identical, but very similar.
Consider yourselves, how would you classify yourselves as Jewish? Just so I know.
How would you classify? What would you call yourself? You're a blank Jew.
Like,
if I'm a blank Jew.
If you
Jew,
want to classify.
Just so you know, folks, like 90%
yeah,
deaf and one
year
old. Sometimes I'll just repeat for his sake. So it's not because, you know.
You're not translating.
I'm not translating.
So when I say Orthodox, I'm learning from, because if somebody asks me, I'd be like, well, I've learned from Orthodox Jews. You guys are that.
So the religion that I subscribe to is Orthodox Judaism.
Okay.
Now, do I live up to the tenets of Orthodox Judaism? The answer is no, I don't.
Oh, okay.
But Orthodox Judaism is broad enough that, tell me if you agree with this, an equivalent idea would be Protestantism is too broad, but evangelical Christian could be, maybe you could say is like Orthodox Judaism, but think of how broad that can even be.
Okay. Yeah, okay. That's
so
fine.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Maybe something between those.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Steve?
I have a personal question for you. If you had enough evidence to think that Jesus was God, would that change your idea of whether he was Messiah?
If you had enough evidence that Jesus was divine, was God, would that convince you that he was Messiah?
Oh, I would. So ask the question again.
If there was sufficient evidence for you to believe, okay, Yeshua was God,
yes,
would he now be the Messiah?
Came down out of the
cloud. Not necessarily, but I would definitely, I don't know how you would want to say it.
You got to think pretty hard about that, right?
Yeah.
Reconsider?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's almost like what he said earlier when I was posing the question to him in the back. So if somebody came in here into the room and basically he gave out his laundry list of things and he goes, and clearly, and I'm telling you right now, I'm not Jesus. Are you going to reject Jesus now? And Scott said, well, I'm going to have to give him an ear. So I would give him a definite
ear. And so Steve's follow-up question is...
That wouldn't necessarily convince you that he is Messiah.
So it wouldn't necessarily,
convince you that he's Messiah.
No.
In the same way that I need more data... Well, in all fairness, in the same way that the guy came in, let's say that we're all mistaken and Jesus isn't Messiah. The guy came in who was the real Messiah. Although I wouldn't automatically be like, well, I've heard 6 seconds of your testimony. I'm going to throw out 20 years of my own. You're going to want to look into it further. So I think that it's fair for them to say... You know what, if I was convinced Jesus was divine,
I need to go back to the Torah, I need to go back to Tanakh, I need to go back to my old writings, read them again, and let me consider it now, because now I know Jesus is God. I think that's fair.
What is the point of the Messiah? You know, why are you looking for Messiah?
Why are you looking for Messiah? What's the point of Messiah?
I don't know. I would agree pretty much with him, is that the importance that he's going to bring to get rid of, we call this world Alma Deshikra. In other words, we are in a world of lies. That's the Aramaic for world of lies. And to fix everything, rectify everything, put us where we can go back to black and white. And that's what I think is extremely important, at least. That would be a nice way to put it.
Will Messiah be better at that than God would be otherwise? I think that injects the idea that God doesn't work through Messiah there. Does it? So before Nask, go ahead, sorry.
No,
I think God's sitting here. Why would he need somebody over here that says he's Messiah to tell you something God couldn't tell you?
So where in this questions that you're asking is God telling us this directly?
Well, I think maybe, let me try an angle at it. If there was enough evidence to suggest that Jesus is divine, it would cause somebody to reconsider things. It wouldn't do all that, because all of a sudden I'd have to ask, well, what does that mean to say Jesus is divine? Does it mean that he's literally the person of God incarnated in a man? Does it mean that somehow God has imbued a man with divinity in some fashion? What, and so that's what would first go on before you'd have to do anything else. And
in all fairness, when that did happen, it was like 300 years later until they were like, okay, fine, we've got an agreement on what it is. Yeah.
So that's
maybe
what would
300 years after that, and then we're okay.
That's what would happen first, and you would have to rethink all of the things that you understood previously. Because ostensibly, when you look at the Hebrew Bible, the idea of God coming as a man, it's not there in any explicit fashion. And you would think, just not, you know, just looking at the Hebrew Bible alone, that is an extremely unlikely, like, fat chance. It just, no, because that's what all the pagans do. The pagans think their guy is God, and boy, so you'd be starting at ground zero again. You've gone back to home base, and you're starting to reconstruct things. And I think that's really what it would do, right?
Before an ask question, sorry, I want to hear the answer to why did God raise Yeshua from the dead?
So, why do you believe God raised Jesus from the dead?
And maybe clarify for me, are you saying, I'll grant for the sake of argument, or do you actually believe he was resurrected?
Oh, I'm granting it for the sake of argument.
Okay, gotcha.
And so...
I misunderstood you earlier to say you believed he was raised from the dead. Disregard. Nah.
Well, it's kind of a difficult way to conceive of this, but if there is a master plan, or if God's master plan includes agency, would there be any sort of logic that you would say the Jews, the Hebrews, the Jewish tradition is part of his agency to bring the beginning, or have a audit from the beginning to the end? So at the White Throne Judgment, I think Augustine says that the Jews have been protected, you know, or chosen over the course of time for a specific purpose to interpret the law. And I guess he references maybe it's Romans or Hebrews, I can't remember which, but every mouth will be stopped. You know, there will be no excuse, because even those who have been skeptical or who have been agnostic to, you know, any sort of absolute reality will not have an excuse at the end of time, or at the White Throne Judgment, and will be the honest broker, or will be the honest determiner of what has been set forth. Is there any kind of reasonability to that kind of concept?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Yeah, can you rephrase the question? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, the question is that Augustine making that point, that there is a specific purpose of outside of what we can ascertain of Hebrew tradition and the Jewish community, and the fact that Israel now is a country, all follows a prophecy that seems so mysterious and so unreasonable, but yet it's it's in place, is that evidence of God working a plan so that at the end of time there can be that kind of confirmation that is unambiguous?
Yeah. No. That's almost like what Rav Kook says.
Yeah.
Right. The beginning of the messianic redemption and whatever. Yeah. And to I'll give you a good example. So the state of Israel is created pretty much by secular people. That doesn't mean that they're atheists, by the way.
Right.
So, but they're secular Jews, and they don't necessarily practice the commandments and so on. And once again, I have to reiterate, most people, they hear secular and they think atheist. They're not atheists. They believe in God and so on. However, so the question is asked is, well, why would God use a bunch of secular Jews to recreate the state of Israel and so on? And so we have various rabbis and theologians who come up with different, you know, ideas as to why this may happen. We actually see this once back in history where God uses King Cyrus to go ahead and send people to, you know, to go back, and he's the equivalent of the United Nations, right, in ancient history. And so we would go, well, somebody needs to go and lay the groundwork, do the dirty work, and all those types of things. And so we would say, so those Jews that are secular that went in there and they did that, they are part of this grander plan that is coming forth and so on. There's other people in the ultra-Orthodox community who actually say no, that actually the state of Israel is nothing but a copycat of like real Torah Judaism and so on. So there's going to be competing things about the nature of the state of Israel. Some believe it's a complete blessing and God is working, you know, with the people. And another group is like, no. We are working against God. And they both have very, very good arguments on their side. So it's kind of difficult with that one. Now, if you want to ask me personally what I think,
yeah.
I think that God is working on our behalf. Now, but it's up to us to go ahead and continue to work with him. Okay. So say, for example, 1948, you know, the state of Israel is founded. Great, we start setting up a government. It's not a perfect government, but they're setting up a government. Next thing you know, in the 1960s, Jerusalem is divided. Now it's united once again. Next thing you know, we get into like 2004, 2005. I don't know if you know this, but they started putting together a prototype Sanhedrin.
Yep.
And so there's actually a Sanhedrin in Israel that's the head of it is a guy named Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz. And it has, you know, 71 people that are sitting on it. And the idea, at least for them, is to move into the next phase, is where you know, the chief rabbinate and all those things start to merge into this. But, you know, it's up to us to go ahead and actualize all these types of things. That's why you would see such a large amount of people when the state was giving Gaza, doing its business with Gaza or with the West Bank, and they're giving back land or whatever have you, and they're just going, no, this can't be it, because the term that they use for them is religious Zionist. So they are people who believe that God has put us here now and he gave it to us, so why are we now giving it back? It would be like almost next week, so to speak, let's just pretend that the current prime minister signed the treaty and going, all right, so half of Jerusalem is now going to go back and it's not united, and you start to work in the opposite
direction, right?
Direction. And but we want to go in this direction. In fact, the borders of Israel, it's much larger than what you see it is. The borders of Israel is quite expansive. You know, if you go into Wikipedia and you look up what, you know, biblical Israel is, I'm not talking just the Northern Kingdom, but Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom, you'll be like, whoa, that encompasses Lebanon, it's going to encompass Jordan, it's going to encompass, you know, a lot of things like that. So
I had two quick follow-up questions to her questions, and then maybe a slightly longer one. So first, was it heaven, Gehenna, then reincarnation? Is reincarnation the thing you want the least?
Is reincarnation the what?
The thing you want the least.
Oh, is reincarnation the thing that you want the least?
Yeah.
No, actually, I'm going to use the English terms. So in Gehenna, we have 10 levels. Level number one is the one that you get locked into forever. It's the Christian equivalent of hell.
Right.
Eternal damnation.
That's level one?
Well, two, we're level is the bottom. It only gets worse from there.
Two through ten is you know that you're, let me rephrase this, you will be purified and then you're going to go straight to heaven from there. Problem is that you don't know where you are. So even though you're in the purification phase, you're not informed like that, oh, you're in level two, you're in level three, you're in whatever, because at that point you can go, yippee, and then, you know, ride through the waves and then get out. You don't know this. You're going to go through like intense suffering and all those types of things. That's what Jewish theology teaches.
That's why the belt system is so good. You can be like, one, two, three, four, okay.
That's right. Also, so you said you would describe yourself as Orthodox Jew?
Yes.
Are there other...
No, they would say Jew. Okay. But because we're communicating with somebody who doesn't understand Jew, okay, we'll say Orthodox because that will help you understand them.
I subscribe to Orthodox Judaism.
Okay. Not quite sure how to ask this then, but might there be someone else who would claim I am an Orthodox Jew and then say the two of you are not?
Not what? Orthodox or Jewish?
Orthodox.
Oh, there would be people who would look at us and say, you're not Orthodox.
Okay.
So say, for example, if I went to Williamsburg up in New York, and because we were there just a couple of months back.